877-217-5757, your number. Philip Gould is with us. He's a documentary and architectural photographer. His assignments have taken him throughout the U.S., Europe, and the Caribbean. His photographs have been featured in more than a dozen books, as well as in periodicals around the world. His latest, which came out right in the middle of the pandemic, Bridging the Mississippi, spans across the Father of Waters from LSU Press. It is a beautiful book, and nobody has captured the Mississippi River bridges with their glory like our guest Philip Gould, who joins us in Lafayette. Well, you have had many assignments, and this one is one that took you to a lot of different places. And for those who travel this country and go up or down the Mississippi, the majesty of these bridges is really something to behold, isn't it?
I think so. And, you know, and you have an incredible variety of bridges as well. You have the ones in New Orleans and the Huey P. Long, which is famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, the Crescent City Connection. We have the Sunshine Bridge, which is also has had its moments, and going on up. Some of the bridges date back to the mid-19th century, actually. The oldest one in St. Louis is called the Ease Bridge, opened in 1874. Your listeners may know of a fellow named James Buchanan Ease, who was made famous in part by John Barry's book Rising Tide, and he was hired by the city of St. Louis to build a bridge there. The St. Louis was in serious trouble because they were on the western side of the river. Their rail networks were on the eastern side, and they needed to connect to them. Going further north, you have...
Well, hold on to St. Louis for a moment before we go all over the country on this. Don't they call the bridge in St. Louis the Stan Span? After Stan Musial. Isn't the bridge named in his honor, the great baseball player who had over 3,600 hits for the Cardinals, played for him from 46 to 63? Stan the Man?
There is a bridge in St. Louis named after Stan Musial. It's an interstate bridge, Stan Musial Veterans Memorial Bridge, which is just north of town and handles a large volume of traffic going across. It's also a pretty distinctive bridge, but it is not the historic one that I was talking about. The one that I was talking about is a monumental bridge in terms of its impact in bridge construction, in that it was the first span to use steel in on a large scale. This was an amazingly new technology, Eads knew about it and had the confidence, although he had never built a bridge, that was going to be the ticket to get spans that could be 500 feet apart, so that riverboats and that kind of thing could pass safely underneath. So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, talk about photography, but I could also talk about the history. The history of bridges on the Mississippi is one of those unsung, unknown aspects of 19th century that we don't know that much about, but it was incredibly important. And, it was a combination of the Mississippi itself being just this massive, powerful, dangerous river, you know, and oftentimes on very unstable soil.
All right. We've had some listeners ask about the bridge in Baton Rouge, the so-called New Bridge, which is actually the Horace Wilkinson I-10 Bridge. And you have a spectacular photograph of rush hour, and this has to be one of the most heaviest traveled Mississippi spans in the country.
It may well be. I think actually that the Crescent City Connection has more traffic than the one in Baton Rouge. But Baton Rouge, and Baton Rouge, the Horace Wilkinson Bridge, as we know, is world famous, or at least famous by people who drive on I-10. For having a major interstate highway effectively narrow down to one lane as it heads on through the town off the bridge, which drives many people, including myself, crazy at various times, and has a terrible reputation in the process. I know they keep talking about fixing it and widening it or addressing it, but you know, so far we're still driving on it.
I've actually had people say they've climbed that bridge at night, and my goodness, you talk about something that would be cause for concern about somebody's mental stability. But a lot of college kids do it and live to talk about it, so God bless them for surviving. The Minnesota Bridge, the main one in Minneapolis, a listener asks about, that's an iconic bridge as well, isn't it?
Well, I think they're referring to, well, there's two. One is the Stone Arch Bridge built in 1883, which is a beautiful brick structure, very much out of Roman aqueduct architecture, if you will, with arches. It was key to opening up the Northwest to the east, to eastern markets. There's another bridge now built, I think, in 2008 after the calamitous collapse of the I-10 bridge going from downtown. That is a beautiful structure, incredibly synced, wonderful lines, and it's high-tech to the max. There's sensors all through it. And so you have this wonderful contrast between the two bridges, and then there's a whole bunch of other ones. The river area in Minneapolis is wonderful. I make the point oftentimes that bridges sort of provide the framing for river areas as an urban as a place for people to get away from urbanity, which is close by. And Minneapolis is a classic example of that. The Stone Arch Bridge is a pedestrian bridge now, so people can walk across and just gaze at, you know, the city that surrounds them.
Philip, do you have a personal favorite of those that you photographed?
Personal favorite. I'm a fan. There's several I like. I like the Eads Bridge. I love the ones in Minneapolis. I'm a fan of a small bridge, 1931, in Lansing, Iowa, called the Black Hawk Bridge. And when you talk about, people always use the phrase driving through a time warp or going into a time warp. That's an understatement for how you feel when you cross this. You are truly in another era. It's beautiful. It's odd in its engineering. It feels like three spans kind of connected together badly. But it has worked there, and it is so wonderfully identified with the town. It's a tourist attraction, and it's just beautiful.
The book is Bridging the Mississippi, Spans Across the Father of Waters, and we will spend a few more minutes with Philip Gould, who lives in Lafayette. He is the person, along with Margot Hasha, who put this book together, and it is a remarkable photographic collection, and we'll talk more when we return with Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Philip Gould, a remarkable photographer who lives in great city of Lafayette, the hub city of Louisiana. His book is Bridging the Mississippi, Spans Across the Father of Waters. And there is an exhibit ongoing. Before we get to that, though, Mike Wolf, the godfather of the Libertarian Party, reports that there is a Libertarian in the U.S. Senate race, the election November 3rd. Aaron Sigler, who's a neurosurgeon from Hammond, he is on the ballot. Philip Gould, you have an exhibit right now. Tell us about this. Okay, let's see. There we go. We got Philip now.
Lafayette. Can you hear me?
I can.
Yeah. The Hilliard Art Museum, Hilliard University Art Museum in Lafayette on the campus of UL, has a significant exhibit, 50 of the images from the book. They intend to travel it. It's going to be there for several months into the spring. And if you want, a lot of the photographs of the exhibit are quite large, 4 feet, and you can literally walk into the scene with your eyes. And I think it's well worth checking out for anyone who is a bridge lover or just generally curious about the Mississippi River, the entire length of it. You know, people talk about the river and the bridges. I think of it as a 2,300-mile bridge architecture museum. You just have to drive the whole thing, and you will get a real sampling of the types of bridges that we have in this country and the vintages. It's just pretty amazing.
Well, thank you, Philip, and we look forward to talking with you again. You are a remarkable talent, and it was Tracy at the Capitol asking about the bridge in Memphis, and I'm looking at it right now in Philip's book. It's called the Harahan Bridge. And it is a remarkable piece of architecture as well. Thank you, Philip Gould. We're joined now by Todd Snyder, and he is the author of Bundini, Don't Believe the Hype. And for those of us of a certain vintage, we're fully aware of Drew Bundini Brown, who was an assistant trainer, corner man of the greatest boxer of them all, Muhammad Ali, and Drew Bundini Brown, died in 1987. He was only 59 years old, but he was with the champ for all three championships, including the one in New Orleans, September 15th, 1978, 42 years ago this week. Muhammad Ali, in his last victory as a fighter, dethroned Leon Spinks, who had won the championship 7 months earlier in a split decision over Muhammad Ali, and the victory was at the Louisiana Superdome. But Bundini Brown was a person who obviously melded well with the champ, Todd, and he was an amazing force alongside this great champion. Tell us about the relationship.
You know, one of the amazing things about this story is not just that he worked with Muhammad Ali for 21 years and all of those championships that you mentioned. He also worked with the great Sugar Ray Robinson for 7 years. So to think that Bundini had the best seat in the house, maybe with the two greatest fighters to ever lace up boxing gloves, is sort of a remarkable an achievement, to think that he was in the corner of those wonderful fighters. In regard to his relationship to Muhammad Ali, I think the best way I could describe it is Kalia Ali, who was the champion's second wife, said they were Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. They were like two ornery boys when they got together. They, you know, he brought out the childlike spirit of Muhammad Ali, and they were the best of friends. He was Ali's motivator, and, you know, he was sort of his confidant through the exile and through some of the tough times of his life and career. They were friends all the way to the end.
The book is Bundini, Don't Believe the Hype, from Todd Snyder. When he died, Bundini, in 1987, Muhammad Ali was unable to attend the funeral but sent flowers and a card that read, "You made me the greatest." And in addition to being a corner man, he was a spiritual advisor of sorts, and legend has it that he's the one who coined the "float like a butterfly, sting like a bee" slogan that became part of Ali lore. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. Muhammad Ali had always went on record saying that that was Bundini's line. Bundini was sort of the ghostwriter for a lot of Muhammad Ali's famous rhymes. He, you know, some people I interviewed for the book called him, you know, a street poet or a street philosopher, a spirit coach. He wasn't really a boxing trainer in the traditional sense. You know, Bundini never boxed as an amateur or as a pro, but he was a chief motivator. Maybe today you would think of him as a sports psychologist. He was there to sort of keep Muhammad Ali focused in training, to keep him happy, to keep him motivated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was the loudest voice in the corner, maybe even louder than Angelo Dundee, Ali's head trainer.
Well, as we know, sometimes fights are won or lost in dressing rooms. When we look happened to Michael Spinks against Mike Tyson, he was obviously totally intimidated when he came into the ring and didn't last 2 minutes. That could have happened to Ali, but it never did. He never was counted out. He lost fights, five of them, but he was never counted out. And he was never really embarrassed, although the Holmes fight was brutal. He stayed on his feet for 10 rounds. And in the fight, for example, in the Rumble in the Jungle, October 30th, 1974, against George Foreman, many thought Ali was going to get hurt, not just defeated, but hurt, embarrassed, perhaps seriously injured, and he came out and dominated the fight. Was that in part because Bundini fired him up?
You know, it's true. If you think about when they joined forces, Bundini joins Ali's team for the first Sonny Liston training camp. And if you remember, he was an 11-1 underdog in that fight. Liston had just knocked out Floyd Patterson in the first round in back-to-back fights. And many people thought Ali was too skinny, he had bad technique, he pulled his head straight back, and that Liston was going to make quick work of him. And Bundini really was a big part of that, hyping up that training camp, and they had their sort of psychological gamesmanship that they played on Sonny Liston. And, of course, that's the training camp where he comes up with "float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, your hands can't hit what your eyes can't see." And I think he's a huge part in Ali sort of psyching himself up to beat Liston. And then he sort of repeats that act later in Ali's career when, you know, the champ has taken a couple losses, he's getting a little bit older, he's slowing down, and Foreman is the new Sonny Liston, the guy who knocks people out in the first couple rounds. And one of the things that was really fun to write about in the book
is I was given the opportunity to interview George Foreman for the book. And I would have assumed that Foreman had never met him until they faced off in Zaire, which it wasn't true. Foreman and Bundini had their own friendship, and they had become friends while Ali was in exile. So one of the neat parts about that chapter in the book is that Bundini sort of has this friendship triangle. He's friends with Foreman and Ali, but he knows that he has to repeat that same sort of psychological gamesmanship that he employed with Liston when it comes time to face this monster of a guy, George Foreman.
In 1975, a year later, October 1st, in Manila, we had the Thriller in Manila. And that fight, Ali was not as prepared as he should have been. He also was 33, and he's fighting 31-year-old Joe Frazier. Both past their prime, but both ferocious and fierce competitors who refused to give up. But at one point in the fight, Ali thought he was defeated and went to the corner and supposedly said, cut the gloves. Bundini and Angelo Dundee talked him out of it, didn't they?
Yes, and one of the things we talk about in the book is that happened a couple times in Ali's career. And more recently, Ali's brother Rahman wrote a book about his relationship with his brother, and he wrote in the book, Ali probably would have three or four more losses on his career if not for Bundini, because he was that chief motivator who says, you can't quit. You're fighting for more than just yourself. You represent more than just who you are. And, you know, there were a couple times in Ali's career where it was not going his way, and Bundini sort of picked his spirit up and got him back in the fight. You know, Frazier's corner stops the fight, but in the other corner, Ali was ready to quit as well. It's interesting to think how different history would be if Angelo and Bundini had thrown in the towel and Frazier would have won two out of three fights. We would probably think differently about their rivalry in boxing history
That
had been the case.
And I think there would have been a fourth fight too, but
probably so, right?
Fortunately, did not happen. They might have killed each other. But in the first fight between Frazier and Ali, I remember watching that on closed circuit television in Little Rock's Robinson Auditorium, $8. 1971, March 8th, Ali coming out of enforced retirement, not physically fit as he should have been, and it goes 15 rounds, and he gets knocked down in the 15th round. He gets right up, but didn't Bundini throw water in the ring?
Yeah, and he was fined by the New York State Athletic Commission. He threw water, and if you watch the tape, it smacks Ali right in the face and sort of wakes him up a little bit. And I remember George Foreman, who I interviewed, said he was ringside for that fight. And he said that was his lasting memory, is how in the world could he be so accurate with water? I mean, he threw like a wet sponge or something, and the water hit Ali right in the face. And who knows whether or not it woke him up or if it did, you know. But it did happen, and Bundini was fined for it.
Well, one of the untold stories was after he got up, he actually won the last part of that round. But, of course, the fight was all but over when Frazier put him down in the 15th round.
Right.
But Ali always got up, and Bundini was always there. But did they stay too long at the dance? The last fight against Holmes and then the one after that against Trevor Burbick, they were brutal.
Yeah.
Why did he do it?
Yes, absolutely. Look, it's been long documented. If you've done your research on Ali, he was having some financial problems late in his career. And I know it's perplexing to think that Ali couldn't have made money doing other things. But he was having some money problems, and maybe he was a little bit addicted to the limelight as well. He definitely stayed two fights too long and, you know, suffered the damage.
The book is Bundini from Todd Snyder, and it's about a guy whose story needed to be told, and Todd has done it well. Thank you for joining us. Signature support comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Have a great weekend. Stay safe and stay tuned.